This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Neil Gorsuch is President Trump's nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court left by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. As you know, Republicans in Congress refused even to hold hearings on President Obama's choice to fill the seat, so the vacancy has left the court for quite a while with an ideological 4-4 split. If the Senate approves the Gorsuch nomination, that will tilt the balance back to where it was, 5-4, in a more conservative direction. So what will this mean for cases from North Carolina that may make their way to the high court? What does this return to the previous balance mean for legislative redistricting, voter rights, LGBT rights, which have all have implications for our state? Well, we've invited a couple of professional court watchers and constitutional experts to join us. Dr. John Schmier is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. His research examines the U.S. Supreme Court and courts of appeals, and we welcome you back.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. And Dr. Andrew Ogeen, Ogeen is Davidson College MacArthur Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science, whose expertise centers on the dynamics of the Supreme Court, including the cooperative behavior of the justices. They're known to cooperate?
On occasion.
Thank you for joining us as well. What did the president's choice surprise you? Because there were a couple of people on a short list, and I believe he was going to bring the two finalists to Washington, so we couldn't guess which one it was until the magic moment of the announcement. Did the choice surprise either of you? Dr. Schmier.
It didn't really surprise me that much. So there were three that made the short list. Had it been prior, that might have been surprising because he had a very contentious battle to get onto the lower court. There are some aspects of his prior record that are concerning to a lot of Democrats. Picking Pryor meant itching for a fight. Mm-hmm. Picking Gorsuch means picking somebody who is more traditional and more well-qualified than even Pryor. It's almost a no-brainer pick.
Dr. Ogeen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it was the best choice, I think, in the context, and certainly the one that was likely to engender the least objection, assuming a sort of constant level of objection.
So how does this guy, Neil Gorsuch, compare to Merrick Garland? How does he compare? Because Merrick Garland was chosen because they thought Republicans would like him.
In terms of background, fairly similar. I believe they both went to Harvard Law School, both did extremely well at Harvard Law School, both had prestigious clerkships, both very well-respected judges, respected in part because they write very clearly. There are some things about Gorsuch that are a little bit more unique. For example, he has a doctorate from Oxford in legal philosophy, that separates him from some others. And then, of course, ideology. Garland was thought of, and it's always hard to predict these things, but I'm going to proviso here, but Garland was thought to be a moderate left judge. Gorsuch is not thought to be a moderate. He's thought to be a conservative in the mold of Scalia.
And yet, it was rumored that it was believed that this guy, Neil Gorsuch, Judge Gorsuch, would be more palatable to Democrats than some of the other possible choices. And yet his process is going to probably be pretty contentious, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the process was likely to be contentious regardless of who was chosen. I think Gorsuch's his pedigree and his record and the respect that he enjoys across the aisle is going to make the process, you know, maybe marginally less contentious. Mm. And certainly Garland enjoyed quite a bit of cross-aisle respect as well. He was a prosecutor for the Oklahoma City – or one of the prosecutors for the Oklahoma City bombing case, and so that sort of endeared him to a lot of the Republicans.
And I didn't know this till last night. I was watching one of the newscasts, and they said if he sails through and he's confirmed, he will be the only Protestant – on the court.
Right.
And
it's
I thought, that can't be right. And I looked it up, and it is. That, who knew? Does that mean? What are the implications of that?
Well, so I think it's been 36 years since a Republican nominated somebody who wasn't Catholic. And the reason for that, obviously, is an assumption that they'll be very strong on pro-life positions. Gorsuch, they don't need that signal. He wrote a book on euthanasia, which I believe was basically his dissertation from Oxford, that took a very strong pro-life stance. Mm-hmm. So they have, in a sense, a cue, just like being a Roman Catholic is a cue of your opinion. It's not perfect information, but it's a good sign that they didn't need him to be Catholic.
Judge Gorsuch said that he was always puzzled when he heard other people in his profession refer to some of his colleagues as lions in the legal profession, except when it came to Judge Scalia. Clearly, he liked Scalia. He knew Scalia pretty well. Is he cut from the same cloth?
He has a lot in common with Scalia, I think intellectually. He is widely regarded as a very strong writer. If you look at some of his opinions from his time on the Tenth Circuit, his writing is very, very clear, very concise. He makes his argumentation is very strong, and that, I think, is a lot in line with what Scalia's reputation. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's quite as
bombastic?
Yeah, I think that's a good word, John, as Scalia was. And so in that regard, maybe not. Maybe a little bit more willing to sort of concede points.
Was Scalia bombastic from the start, or did that come with time and comfort on the court and the fact that this is, after all, a lifetime appointment? You can't fire me.
So I think his personality was basically, you know, he's a charming guy. Uh-huh. He had friends on the other side of the aisle. He and Ginsburg had served together on the lower court and were good friends, would go drink wine, go to the opera together. So I think he's a genial person, but he's kind of the guy or the person in the locker room that makes fun of everybody, I think is the sense. So I'm not sure they took it too seriously. But, you know, there was never the sense that the other justices on the court didn't like him. But he would publicly call them out and
right.
publicly call out the conservative judges as much as he would the liberal judges when he thought they were wrong, in language that was often amusing. But the thing that he shares with Gorsuch is they have the same perspective when it comes to looking at the Constitution. There are different methods of constitutional interpretation. One of them is to look at the meaning of the words when they were written. And, you know, this is what we would call textual originalism. And, you know, Scalia is arguably the leading proponent of it. And Gorsuch is, you know, arguably one of his apostles or maybe a second generation mm-hmm. original textualist. So they see the Constitution from the same lens. And that's probably the thing that matters most, not personality.
So he's an interpreter of the – he's an originalist? Is that – what's the word that they use for this?
Well, so the thing is there's two types of originalism actually and arguably a third. One is to try to put yourselves in the mind of the people that wrote the Constitution
right.
and try to guess what they were thinking. We used to call that original intent. That largely because of Scalia has been – but also liberals like former Justice Brennan has been discredited. It's very hard to predict anybody. You know, why should we think we could put ourselves in the minds of politicians or trust what the politicians say? Because, again, the framers of the Constitution were politicians. We don't trust them now. Why should we trust them then? All sorts of problems with this idea of original intent. And so originalism morphed into, well, okay, it's not original intent. It's original meaning. And so that's the perspective that Gorsuch and Scalia have.
Okay. So whoever, whether he goes through or not, whoever Donald Trump puts forth is going to be a conservative, and that will restore the 5-4 conservative over liberal split on the court. So are we just returning to stasis here? Is there going to be any substantial difference from the way it was when Antonin Scalia was on the court?
It's unlikely. I mean, you know, we had several years of a 5-4 split with the conservative bloc sort of holding a majority on a lot of issues. Kennedy is really very much in the middle. I mean, there are some issues that he sides with the conservatives on, and there are some issues he sides with the liberals
and
on.
That's the way it was before.
And that's the way it was before. And so, yeah, we are sort of in large part returning to what the status quo was before Scalia passed.
Well,
yeah.
He is conservative on some – Kennedy is conservative on some issues, liberal on others. He's inconsistent. Is that unusual?
Well, okay. So I like to call him a swing voter, not somebody who's a moderate. Because some of his positions on things like federalism, affirmative action until recently, some criminal justice issues, he's very conservative. On other issues like sexual orientation, he's actually fairly liberal. He just sort of averages out, to be moderate, but it's more like a hodgepodge of liberal and conservative opinions, and the court tilts to whichever side he's on. I don't think it's that odd. We've had some Justice Powell, Justice Stewart, Justice White at various times who have, held positions that aren't consistent ideologically. It is fairly rare, though. Most of the time, justices are fairly consistent. But even Scalia, the way those of us that look at the courts, for the most part, he's fairly liberal on free speech issues, for example, from the perspective we usually use when we approach studying the courts.
Whenever openings happen on the Supreme Court, partisans always try to find people who reflect their worldview and will bring that worldview, at least of the Constitution, to the court. But the word qualifications and qualified keeps popping up as well. And I'm curious what that means, because the Constitution doesn't spell out what the qualifications for Supreme Court justices are. And in fact, I don't believe you have to have you don't have to be a lawyer to be on the court,
no.
Do you?
No, not technically.
So what is a qualified person? Who is qualified for this job? How do you determine qualification?
Well, for many years we relied on the American Bar Association rating to get a sense for how well qualified nominees were. In recent years, certainly under the Bush administration, there was a sort of move to try and push back against that a little bit. We've developed sort of shortcuts for understanding what qualified means. So, the current court is very much staffed with Ivy League graduates, and so that's usually a heuristic for a lot of people.
He would be the sixth Harvard Law School alum on the court, and the other three went to Yale.
But if you don't have to be a lawyer to be on the highest court in the land, which means you don't have to have had any judicial experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why wasn't that put into the Constitution? Why didn't the founding fathers say these guys have to be lawyers?
Well, you just heard John say that we have no idea about original intent. So maybe, that's not a fair question.
But what I can say is, what it means to be a lawyer now is different from what it meant to be a lawyer then. There was maybe one law school in the entire country back then. Most of the people that considered themselves lawyers trained themselves, and then they apprenticed. So what it means to be a lawyer, that it wasn't as formal as it is today. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't say, well, you have to be admitted to a bar, because there was no bar to be admitted to, at least at that formal level. And I'm not sure that again, it's hard to say what they intended, but maybe they wanted people that, a blend of people that had maybe more practical experience. Clinton had always said he wanted to put a politician on the court.
Hmm. And that might have happened had Hillary Clinton won the White House. Barack Obama, a constitutional scholar, might have gone in there. Who knows? We have to take a break. We're here with Dr. Andrew Schmier from UNC Charlotte Schmier and Andrew O'Gene and Dr. Andrew. We have two Andrews here. We're coming right back, nonetheless. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner Webb University, a Christian liberal arts experience with more than 80 undergraduate and graduate major fields of study, now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.edu. And Dynamic Mounting, offering custom mounts that move any type of screen down to more comfortable viewing heights, designed for over fireplaces or any location that is too high. Details at dynamicmounting.com. On the local news roundup, Marcus Smith makes his case to Major League Soccer. Despite the city's lack of participation, this gives them the time they wanted to make a decision. So will it make a difference? Crime and violence are up at CMS, even as school crime declines statewide. CMPD takes its own look at crime in Charlotte last year at what they learned. And local reaction to Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee. Those stories and more with our roundtable of reporters on this program right here on this dial tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, American higher ed and high tech are looking with dismay at President Trump's view of borders and the world. We'll listen. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join the conversation on Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let's do a reset on the guests' names here. Dr. John Schmier, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, is with us. He, for those of you listening on the radio, is in the cranberry sweater. And Dr. Andrew O'Gene is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. He looks very tweety this morning. All right. Now, we're talking about the Supreme Court and the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to be the replacement for Antonin Scalia. The court is supposed to be apolitical, I suppose, despite all the focus on which way it leans. And many people have already commented that Judge Gorsuch, his rulings are based on law and not politics. And some judges have been accused of being politicians. Is that what makes this such a high stakes thing for who wins the presidential contest, who they get to put on the court, and which way that court leans going forward for generations?
It's important. Trump said, "You know, this pick can be on the court for 50 years." That's probably an exaggeration, but. Your justices often serve now 30, 35, 40 years. So while he doesn't tilt the balance today, if you look at the youngest justices on the court, you now have three relatively young conservatives and two relatively young liberals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're looking 20 years down the road, maybe it affects the balance.
And if you're on the Supreme Court and you're an older person and you lean one way or the other, do you tell yourself when you get up every morning, I have to stay on this court until the next president who feels like me comes into office? Do they actually think about those things, do you think?
I think some of them probably do. They might not admit it publicly, but I think that some of them consider who's potentially nominating their replacement, of course.
So it's not apolitical at all.
No, I'm not sure that it's ever really been apolitical.
No.
despite our sort of maybe public perceptions.
We were talking before the show. Justice Douglas, one of the more liberal justices ever, who had very open political aspirations to be president mm-hmm. one day. Nixon was president. He had a stroke. He was mostly physically, at least, out of commission for an entire term, and still refused to leave the court because he didn't want to. We think didn't want to be replaced right. by a conservative.
What do you think this confirmation process will be like? Tempers are high right now, and there are executive orders coming out before every 2.5 seconds. It seems like will the Democrats stay tough or will they back down? Will they try to do to the Republicans what the Republicans did to them, or will they revert back to their approach, which is usually more accommodating, let's put it nicely?
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats have a bit of a history of being a little more accommodating, I think. Right now, they're talking pretty tough.
But clearly, this man is qualified.
He's definitely qualified. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. And it's likely, at the end of the day, mm-hmm. that he's going to end up on the court. The question is, you know, what level of a fight do the Democrats are the Democrats going to find it useful or beneficial to put up?
So we could go back 30 years to Judge Bork, one of the most qualified justices ever, maybe more qualified than Gorsuch, for example. I should say nominees ever. And he was blocked largely for two reasons. One, ideology. Two, his history. He had fired a couple of attorney generals for Nixon around the Watergate scandal. And another timely thing. Right. And so he was – the Democrats fought him very hard, even though they couldn't fight his credentials. So you can't fight Gorsuch's credentials. What the Democrats want to do is essentially say the seat is illegitimate because Obama had picked Merrick Garland and the Republicans blocked him, didn't even give him a hearing, let alone an up-down vote.
Yeah, they've called this a stolen seat.
Right. And so they're going to try to claim some sort of moral high ground because the seat was stolen and it should be theirs and the replacement shouldn't be as ideologically extreme as Gorsuch is. The thing is, it's not going to work. The problem is there's an election coming in 2018 and the Democrats have more seats open. Something like 10 of those seats are in states that in states that Trump won. Mm-hmm. So they can't afford in red and purple states Democratic senators taking a relatively extreme position on an extremely qualified judge. They're going to have to cave. So there's not much the Democrats can do, and they don't have the numbers anyway.
And the president has said that he would like the Senate to take the nuclear option if there's a great deal of opposition to this. And what are the implications of that, not just for this vote but going forward?
Yeah, I mean they're pretty dire. I think the Democrats in the minority would lose the ability to filibuster any future nominations. But also the Republicans would be sort of tying their own hands, right? I mean, it's not a certainty that the Republicans are going to be in the majority in the Senate in perpetuity. And so
and the Democrats have made a rule change not too long ago that is coming back to bite them.
Right.
And in so this process right now.
The stability of those rules has always been rooted in the fact that the party in power knows that someday they are not going to be in power.
Right.
And so
So are they likely to take – well, first of all, explain the nuclear option, and are they likely to take it?
So let's go back to Bork again, right? So the Republicans felt like the Democrats had gone too far in 1986 challenging Bork. So then in 1995, when the Republicans have the Senate and we have a Democratic President Clinton, they basically fought most of his nominees to the lower court. So then – when Bush takes over and the Democrats have the Senate or a minority in the Senate, but enough votes for a filibuster, they fought at a somewhat historic levels Bush's nominees to the lower court. And then we see the same thing, and it just gets worse every time. Mm-hmm. And so in 2013, Harry Reid was apparently frustrated enough to change the rules when it came to all nominations for cabinet and lower courts, everything but the Supreme Court. Until that point, the Senate, of course, can have unlimited debate to end that. It's called a filibuster. To end that, you need a cloture motion. You need 60 votes for that. But what Reid did was get 51 Democrats to agree to change the rules. So all you need is 51 votes to end debate, which makes it harder for a minority party to block things. So under a filibuster, you just need 41 votes to block a nomination. Now you have to have 51 to block a nomination.
Okay. So if you're a senator and you're in the hearings and you're listening, you're asking questions and you're listening. And when you ask a question of most judicial nominees, they're very they're very evasive. And they're certainly not going to tell you precisely how they're going to vote on abortion or anything else. So what are you listening for? How do you make the decision that this is somebody you can live with?
It's not entirely clear to me that decision is made in the hearing room. I mean, it might be made well before.
Is it all political and horse trading behind the scenes?
There is a lot of that. And, there's certainly quite a bit of grandstanding that happens during the confirmation hearings. The senators see that as an opportunity to, produce a video clip that they can use for a campaign ad or that might end up on the news. John mentioned something earlier about the 2018 election, and I think it's really hard to overstate how important electoral politics are to how this process works. The senators are very aware of the fact or whether or not they're going to face re-election coming up soon, and that is a big part of how they're thinking about this nomination.
John.
And on the one hand, I mentioned those senators in red states are not going to attack Gorsuch. On the other hand, those senators in very blue states are going to want to energize the base for the 2018 and 2020 elections. And the base was very angry about on the Democratic side, was very angry about Garland's nomination. And so you're going to see a lot of rhetoric. You're going to see a lot of yelling. You're going to see a lot of grandstanding against Gorsuch. Mostly, you know, this is a stolen position and that type of rhetoric.
This process, I take it, works exactly like the confirmation processes for cabinet appointments, doesn't it? I mean, it goes to a committee first. They voted out a committee. Then it goes to the full Senate, and they say yes or no to the nomination. Is that fairly much how it works?
Yes, but it's slower.
It's slower.
So we're going to have, 6 weeks or 5 weeks before we even have a hearing? Well, the cabinet members, you want the agencies – you know, you want a smooth transition. You mm-hmm. want people running those agencies. Whoever gets put on this court, you know, and then they're not on there for very long, right? No more than 8 years usually. You know, this person's on there for 30 or 40 years. You want to be more careful, number one. Number two, it's not that big of a rush. They're not likely to participate in any cases until October. They might, you know, do a little bit of work over the summer. So it's not as timely now because we've waited so late in the process.
So will the Supreme Court, as they're waiting for this new person to come on, whoever that person ends up being, are they going to foot drag and delay making decisions, or will they just proceed on as they normally would? Or is it likely that this person will hear any cases this term?
I think it's unlikely they'll hear cases this term,
right.
In large part because they usually won't participate in a case that they haven't heard oral arguments about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure when the nomination will be done, but though it is unlikely to coincide with the end of the oral argument calendar.
So will the court choose not to take certain cases because they're 4-4 and they know they're going to be split down the middle and they'll refer it back to the appeals court?
There are definitely some cases that they'll wait on for sure.
Right. And so there's two ways they can do that. One is just to say, you know, because they make decisions to hear cases on a rolling basis, they mm-hmm. can just, you know, say, well, we're not going to, you know, they just don't have to address that and can wait. The other thing is they might hear a case and then decide that they're deadlocked 4-4, and then they can call for a re-argument next year.
The litmus test in modern times has been abortion,
mm-hmm.
where you stand on abortion. Has there always been a litmus test for judges going back through history? Maybe not on abortion, or do you know?
I think at various times there have been litmus tests. One, for example, for FDR.
Mm-hmm.
His New Deal legislation was originally stymied by conservative judges who didn't like – you had a laissez-faire economic view of the world and would strike down state and federal legislation that regulated business in just about any form.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a litmus test for FDR. He appointed judges who would uphold federal and state legislation
and
business.
And it's difficult – to determine exactly where these people will come down on certain issues because it's difficult, A, to predict the future. And sometimes there are little intricacies in the law that even if the judge is trying to be as apolitical as possible, there's just this little technicality in the law that makes them go in a direction that you find to be surprising or disappointing depending upon your point of view, I suppose. Are there examples of judges who we all thought were liberal or conservative – who turned out to be the exact opposite when they got on the court?
Yeah, I mean the popular example is probably David Souter. I think a lot of the a lot of Republicans felt that they were betrayed by the Souter nomination. He was a sort of lifelong Republican and had been nominated to the lower court by a Republican and. Nominated to the bench or the Supreme Court by George Herbert Walker Bush and turned out to be fairly liberal on a lot of issues. And
how do you explain that?
I think that they didn't do as good a job of vetting him as they probably could have. I'm not sure that he changed his position on a lot of issues. I think that he was sort of acting in the way that he had always acted.
And so – it could be a couple of things, right? Or a lot of factors. So for Souter, I think Bush was reacting to the Bork nomination 4 years prior. Bork had a huge record going back 20 years. We knew everything about him. So the idea was to get somebody they were pretty sure was conservative and put him on the court, but with no record, which then meant they weren't very sure. Eisenhower made what he said were two mistakes because he put very liberal Warren and very liberal Brennan, again, very liberal out of the gate, on the court, even though Eisenhower was a Republican, because he thought they brought political strengths for him. So one was from California with a lot of electoral votes. Then the other one was from New Jersey, which was a bit of a swing state in the next election. So that can have all sorts of factors going on. And then some justices do change. Blackmun, when he was originally put on the court by Nixon, was very conservative, one of the most conservative judges. And we know over time he shifted dramatically. It appears to be a lot of different reasons for that. One is Justice Brennan, and Blackmun became very good friends. Justice Berger, who was very conservative and had grown up with Blackmun, alienated Blackmun. And so some of it may have been personal. The death penalty played a role. They hear a lot of death penalty cases. And so for some of the conservative judges, that grows on them.
There are several issues in North Carolina that it is thought state lawmakers have been waiting on a nine-person court to resolve. Last week, Republican leaders here asked the Supreme Court to review a lower court ruling striking down the state's voter ID requirement and other election changes. Is it probable, especially if Gorsuch is confirmed, that he will rule on this if the court decides to take it on? Or is it one of those cases that may get pushed down the road and where he won't be on the court yet when they decide?
Well, there's two cases that involve North Carolina directly, right?
Election cases.
Yes. Yeah. And one of them there's been oral arguments in already. Isn't that right?
The redistricting case? I don't know for sure.
Okay. Regardless, if the court decides to hear these cases, then yes, he will.
So do we know how he feels about voter rights and about redistricting and gerrymandering and things like that? Is there anything in his record that would indicate how he might perceive these cases?
I don't believe so.
Because Peggy emails, I'm concerned about voting rights in North Carolina and the country. Between Trump, Sessions, and the Supreme Court, I think the Voting Rights Act will be gutted. Is that a possibility?
So, again, if he's using the same interpretive principles that Scalia used, and if, like both of them say, if you use this principle the same way, you should come up with the same outcome every time. Scalia believed in gutting the VRA and had taken, we had voted to take steps to gut the VRA. So, yeah, I think it's not unreasonable to assume that he will take a conservative position on both pieces of legislation. He will, potentially be a fifth vote to strike down both the, voter ID and the other requirements that, that came the day after the court restricted the VRA the last time. And then I think the same thing with the redistricting case. So that's a little trickier.
So the important thing to remember about the Voting Rights Act, though, is that the challenges to the Voting Rights Act and the action by the Supreme Court with respect to the Voting Rights Act are largely statutory, right? They haven't ruled on the constitutional questions directly. And so Congress is very much free to amend the Voting Rights Act in light of what the Supreme Court has said. They're unlikely to do so.
Right.
But, as of right now, the Supreme Court has not sort of eliminated voting rights as a eliminated constitutional protections for voting rights.
In one of the North Carolina cases, the Federal Appeals Court ruled that North Carolina and their 2013 election overhaul targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, making the overhaul unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a 4-4 split. They may have a different point of view. But we get to a 5-4 split, conservative versus liberal. Are they likely to overturn the appeals court decision? We'll get an answer to that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mille Lacs Jewelers, direct diamond importers at the Arboretum, dedicated to consumer protection, ethical business practices, and gemological knowledge. Information about financing options available at MilleLacsJewelers.com. And Theater Charlotte presenting Crimes of the Heart, a Southern Gothic comedy about three sisters dealing with romantic issues and past resentments. Now through Sunday, tickets at CarolinaTix.org. The high-tech industry and America's higher education community, including universities here in the Charlotte area, have been vocal about President Trump's executive action on refugees and immigrant travel. So, as part of On Point's 100-day spotlight, their views about the president's border policy, coming up with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The classic 70s sitcom One Day at a Time has gotten a 21st century reboot on Netflix. Star Justina Machado says the new show pushes boundaries a lot like the old one did by being real.
What we do on the show is we talk to each other. There's a lot of compassion. There's a lot of listening. There's a lot of learning from each other.
And a lot of laughs. Justina Machado later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Supreme Court and the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to replace Antonin Scalia on the High Court. Dr. John Schmier is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Andrew Ogeen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. So getting back to the 2013 overhaul in North Carolina that the appeals court said targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, making it unconstitutional. If we get this 5-4 split conservative to liberal on the Supreme Court, are they likely to overturn that appeals court decision?
So it's a tricky case. On the one hand, you had a conservative district court judge who said it was constitutional. Then you had at least two liberal court of appeals judges that said that, you know, it was unconstitutional. Which suggests there's a partisan divide there, which would suggest the court would overrule it. But on the other hand, the Court of Appeals did point out some very interesting things. I mean, the timing is suggestive. The Supreme Court said the Department of Justice under the Voting Rights Act no longer has the power to clear in advance all legislation in places that used to discriminate based on race in elections. And then the next day, all of those laws were passed by the General Assembly. The other problem, according to the Court of Appeals, the General Assembly asked people to look at the racial effects of different pieces of legislation, found that some of them were detrimental to people of color, and passed them anyway.
And these laws in North Carolina have been described as among the most restrictive in the country. So if the court strikes this down, this appeals court decision down, what are the ramifications nationwide? Because there are other states that have tried to do similar things.
Yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen how other courts will respond to the Supreme Court's precedent. If the court does strike the North Carolina changes down, there will likely be lawsuits in other states challenging those state laws. And, you know, the courts of appeals are free to kind of interpret the Supreme Court's decision relative to what's happening in the in their state. And, you know, in some instances, I'm sure some of those courts will follow what the Supreme Court did. And in some instances, they will, you know, challenge what the Supreme Court said.
And keep in mind, the Supreme Court's decision, okay, so, I mean, they could uphold the legislation, which is possible. If you look straight at ideology, this politics, the legislation favors Republicans. That's pretty clear. So they, you know, if they vote based on politics, they'll likely uphold the legislation, which is possible. But if they do decide to strike it down and say it's unconstitutional, they could do it on very narrow grounds, right? They could say it's the timing, which is very idiosyncratic to North Carolina, and it's the fact that they, you know, searched out for the racial implications. Other places that don't have the same suggestive intent of discrimination, which is what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, that this suggested intent to discrimination, their laws still could be constitutional, even though they're similar laws.
There's another big issue. And North, well, there are a lot of big issues, but there's another one in North Carolina and the former governor, Pat McCrory. And I think some state lawmakers kept waiting and hoping that the Supreme Court would decide on the constitutionality of HB 2 because that would take it off their hands. Since the legislature seems unlikely at this moment in time to repeal that bill, is this something that will likely find its way to the Supreme Court?
So there's actually a case now that
one
is
in Virginia.
Similar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about bathroom choice in a high school in Virginia. The thing is, that case actually hinges on the Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX, which prohibits discrimination based on sex. Without getting too complicated, the Supreme Court can avoid deciding that case if the Trump Department of Education changes how they internally interpret Title IX, and then we wouldn't get to the issue at hand, mm-hmm. and certainly wouldn't even get to the constitutional issue. But that doesn't mean that HB2 might not find its way up there. I don't think the Gorsuch appointment affects how the Supreme Court would decide HB2 at all.
Because?
Sexual orientation cases always come down to Kennedy. He has written the majority opinion every single time.
That's right.
And he leans towards either punting on procedural grounds, which he did once, or taking a liberal to moderate liberal viewpoint in protecting the rights of people not to be discriminated against based on sexual orientation.
Hmm. You say also, Dr. Shamir, that we're all focusing on the ninth justice with this nomination, but given the age of some of the other justices, we should also be focusing on the 10th. Now, I'd never heard of this before, but the 10th justice becomes the Solicitor General. Is that correct?
So this is informal, right? There was a book that was called The 10th Justice, and all that means is the fact that the Solicitor General and his or her office is very influential, right? So they represent the United States before the Supreme Court, either as a party or as a friend of the court. And they participate in an overwhelming majority of the cases, and there's lots of evidence that shows that the judges tend to defer to them. So the choice of that person matters. And right now, the short list appears to be Kellyanne Conway's husband, George, who doesn't have much experience before the court, versus Charles Cooper, who's argued before the court many times, was in the Reagan Justice Department, worked on Bush v. Gore, and clerked for the U.S. Supreme Court.
I want to make sure that I understand this. Are you saying that the 10th justice, the next justice after—
No. The 10th justice is just informal. It's just that they're so influential that they're almost like a 10th justice.
I see.
It's like the 12th man in Seattle for the Seahawks, right? The crowd is so important in determining outcomes of games there that they're almost like a player.
I got you. Okay. So it's not a justice on the court.
No. I mean, they're there a lot, but—
Well, getting back to Neil Gorsuch, you say, Dr. Shamir, that he's extremely well-qualified. As we've gone through his resume, Columbia, Harvard, Oxford, he clerked for two Supreme Court justices. He fits the mold, but that doesn't— That bothers you a little bit, I think, Dr. Ogene, because you said that we're getting pretty homogenous up there. There's not a lot of diversity in terms of background.
Yeah.
Not ethnicity, or although there's some of that too, but it's the background, where they came from, their education.
Yeah.
Why is that important?
Well, diversity in general is important, I think, and it's important to think about diversity in a sort of multifaceted way. So it's not just about race and ethnicity. It's not just about gender. It's about life experience and work experience and education. And the court is moving in a more diverse direction on issues of racial and ethnic diversity, issues of gender diversity, but they're moving in the other direction in terms of diversity on educational background and prior work experience. And so most of the justices are prior appellate court judges, and all of them went to Ivy League law schools. And so I think anytime you have a sort of concentration of experience and education, it can potentially be detrimental. I mean, that's not to say it's guaranteed to be a problem. But I mean, I think generally speaking, in a situation where people are being deliberative, diversity of viewpoints and backgrounds is beneficial.
So they'd be in the Ivy League bubble in terms of their experience with the world. Is that what you're saying?
Probably, except for Sotomayor. I mean, so she was, Princeton, Harvard, but at least she grew up middle class. Mm-hmm. Gorsuch's mom ran the EPA under Reagan for a short while. Many of them, Breyer is married to somebody who's part of the British nobility. These are, very well-to-do people.
Yeah.
Thomas also grew up middle class. But beyond that, there's not much socioeconomic diversity on the court. Like we mentioned before, Clinton was interested in people that maybe had political experience and things like that because they could understand what people wanted and a broader political perspective and the implications of their decisions. And these, eight of the judges, worked on the U.S. Courts of Appeals, Kagan is the only one that didn't. She was dean of Harvard Law School, and she was the Solicitor General herself.
Well, the one thing that's been said about Neil Gorsuch, aside from his Ivy League education and his education at Oxford, is the fact that he's a Westerner, and they bring a different point of view to things, or potentially.
I just want to point out he's not the only Westerner technically on the court.
Right.
Kennedy is actually from California, which last time I checked was the West. I think what they mean is, I think what they're thinking is California is its own world. But in terms of the Mountain West, in terms of that idea that there's this personality for people from the mountain region of the country that's more independent, more Old West style, individualistic thinking, that may be part of it, though he also spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. too.
Yeah. Historically, the appointments to the court have been geographically driven, or there's a history of sort of geography being important to specific seats on the court. It's not unusual to think about sort of finding someone that doesn't necessarily come from California or New York or the Northeast. I think, their geographic background is part of what makes up their sort of decision making. But
so we know for a fact that President Trump will have at least one Supreme Court nominee confirmed, and there may be others in the next 4 years. But what we also know is that he's likely to have a much bigger impact on the lower courts, the district courts, the courts of appeals. He has 103 vacancies to fill. Why so many?
So years we were talking about, right? So over time in the last 30 years, the fight for these lower court nominations has gotten worse continually, and to the point where even with no filibuster for these lower court nominations, the Republicans have still managed to block them.
Obama was trying to put them in, and fewer of his appointees to the lower courts were confirmed than almost any president in recent history.
Proportion-wise. And so keep in mind that there are all sorts of arcane processes that are still in place. They got rid of the filibuster for these nominations, but you can still have one senator block a nomination. Jesse Helms blocked nominations to the Fourth Circuit for about 20 years. It's very easy to be an obstructionist.
And yet these lower courts at the moment are more liberal than the Supreme Court, because 16 out of the last 24 years of appointments were by Democratic presidents.
Yeah, significantly more liberal. So, for example, that Fourth Circuit, which governs the Carolinas, the Virginias, and Maryland, so it's the circuit that governs us. They went from a very conservative court at the beginning of the Clinton administration to one, that's part of what the conservatives would say is all the judicial social engineering in cases like sexual orientation.
And the Washington Post reports that of the 179 judgeships in circuit courts, 90 were appointed by Democrats, 72 by Republicans, with 17 vacancies. It's hard to do on the radio with all these numbers, but the district courts, 347 of the 677 were appointed by Democrats, 242 by Republicans, 88 vacancies to fill. And the Post went on to say that in recent years, the Supreme Court has reduced its caseload to 80 cases per year. Only 12% of those are submitted for review, which means many of the cases now get their final hearing in those lower courts. Given the number of vacancies, is this where we will see the sea change?
Well, a lot of people will make the argument that, it's always been the lower federal courts that are where most of the action is. And so the proportions in terms of the numbers of cases that are decided is really, really heavily favored towards the lower federal courts. Mm-hmm. The numbers are pretty staggering. I mean, I always sort of use a 60,000 number because that's the number that sort of sticks in my head. I'm sure I read it somewhere. 60,000 cases decided at the lower federal appeals court level. Mm-hmm. Annually, relative to 70 at the Supreme Court.
And keep in mind, of those 70, maybe 15 of those actually are constitutional cases that come from state Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about reviewing maybe 50 or 60 out of 60,000.
So if Gorsuch goes to the Supreme Court, there'll be another opening on the lower courts. The 10th district will have an opening. There are already vacancies on the 2nd, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 11th circuits as well. Are these courts just divided up by geography, or are there substantial differences in how these courts reach their decisions?
So they're divided by geography and they're substantial differences.
Okay. So let's see here. Where do we go from here? Oh, John emails, while we focus on the differences in the justices, isn't it the case that on the vast majority of decisions, more mundane decisions perhaps, that the court is 9-0, and don't justices often get along pretty well despite political differences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, most of the cases that the court decides are either unanimous or don't involve a high degree of conflict between the justices. And even in the cases when the justices are at odds with one another, personal relationships on the court tend to be fairly strong. They understand that it's an intellectual give and take, and they have been able over the course of their time on the courts, I think, to view a lot of these issues in abstraction, mm-hmm. Which helps reduce the feelings a little bit.
If you were on the Senate committee, what would you be asking Neil Gorsuch? Or what do you think he is likely to be asked about?
Am I a Democrat or a Republican? So, if I'm a Republican, I am going to give him softball questions so that he can establish that he is a so-called just judicial restraintist. So he doesn't let ideology or politics interfere with his decision making, that he uses neutral principles, that he defers essentially to the framers, and that he won't change things, that he won't be a politician in a black robe. If I'm a Democrat, I am going to hammer him on his view on Roe versus Wade and those other issues that rile up the Democrats. If I'm Gorsuch, I am going to say those issues may come before the court while I serve in there, so I'm not going to answer that question.
Great. You have 20 seconds.
Yeah, I would just sort of reiterate what John says. I think those questions are largely driven – are not necessarily focused on getting a response from the nominee, which doesn't often happen. They're usually sort of an opportunity for the senators to make a statement.
Dr. Andrew Ogeen from Davidson College, Dr. John Schmier from UNC Charlotte. Thanks for the hour. We'll have to stay.